You want to get a debate going? Just ask folks who the nation's greatest president was. Lincoln and Washington will have their backers. So will Reagan and FDR and maybe even good old Harry Truman. But then ask who was the nation's worst president, and the debate usually dies away pretty quickly. Andrew Johnson and, of course, Warren Harding. Newsflash, Harding wasn't considered a failure during his lifetime. And if you could have seen the crowds lining the railroad tracks to see his body after he died, you might have flashed back to earlier times when citizens lined the tracks to see McKinley, James Garfield, or even Abraham Lincoln. Now a conversation about one of our most unpopular and least understood presidents, Warren Harding of Ohio. Our guest is historian Philip Payne, who offers the first significant reinterpretation of the controversial presidency in his book, Dead Last, The Public Memory of Warren G. Harding's Scandalous Legacy. Phil Payne is an associate professor of history at St. Bonaventure University in Western New York. And so good to have you here, Phil. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, the first sentence of your book goes like this: Warren G. Harding's story is an American myth gone wrong. What do you mean, gone wrong?
Well, I mean, if you look at Harding and his biography, it's almost a perfect political biography in that he's born to humble backgrounds, small town. His father served in the Civil War. He's the first president born after the Civil War. He's a self-made man. He goes into business.
He's a newspaper publisher.
He's a newspaper publisher.
So I liked him right away.
He's very successful at it. He's if he had simply not been president, he would have gone down in Ohio as a well-known senator. You know, I mean, certainly wouldn't have had national stature, but he would have. You know, he would not have been considered a failure. And then he runs for president, and he runs on this sort of log cabin myth, the sort of old-fashioned, he runs a front porch campaign, and he really plays up this. This is proof that in America, anybody can grow up to be president. And he presents himself as a booster. He's sort of Babbitt before it's bad to be Babbitt. And he's very well-liked as a president. So that's what I mean about. But then after his death, he dies in office, August 2nd, 1923, which incidentally does lead to these comparisons to Kennedy later on. You know, mm-hmm. A similar 1,000 days in office, dies, very popular. But with Harding, after his death, you have a series of scandals that break.
And after he dies.
After he dies.
That's key here. Yeah.
This is absolutely key. It starts to leak a little while mm-hmm. he's president, but it really hits. It really hits after his death in office.
You know, before we get to that, I just wanted to point out that I was surprised to read just how progressive of a man he was on any number of fronts, Phil, beginning with women's suffrage, a big supporter of it, and including child welfare. As I said, he's a former newspaper publisher. He allowed questions at news conferences, which I thought is just a great idea. Tell us about just how progressive this man was.
Kind of the way I look at it is, I mean, what you do is typically you see Harding as ushering in this age of conservative Republican rule. So it's Harding, Coolidge, and then Hoover.
Yeah.
But the way to really understand Harding is he's a small-town booster. So he really values this community harmony. And he also values the role of women in the community. And you see that with Florence Harding is prominent in his campaign. It's also worth noting this is the first national election that women can vote in.
Huh.
So part of the campaign that you're talking about, especially the support of women's suffrage.
It helped them get some votes, it sounds like.
Partly both parties are like, women can vote. How do we deal with this?
Mm-hmm.
So actually the very last event he has in his front porch campaign is called Social Justice Day, where he brings women voters in and he appeals to them on this sort of progressive platform mm-hmm. of – we're going to do the things you just mentioned. So that has a lot to do with it. But also it's just shifting definitions of what these things mean.
We're talking about the presidency of Warren Harding. I should point out that Phil Payne speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Plaza Branch. You can RSVP and grab a seat at kclibrary.org. Well, Phil, what kind of man was he? I mean, if we could somehow head out to lunch with him today, what kind of experience would we all have together?
I think on a personal level, you'd have a great time. Mm-hmm. Harding he's often criticized for this. I'm not actually sure why, but he's a hell fellow well met. He he likes to hang out.
He's a good-looking guy. Women loved him.
He was actually, that was one of his calling cards, that he looked like a president. That gets said about him over and over again. He's compared to a Roman senator. And that's not, that seems trivial, but it's not, because this election, the 1920 election, is the first election that you really see movies being used. And that packaging of a president as an advertising commodity really starts to come into full bloom. So that he looks presidential, he looks the part, is not accidental. I mean, it's very important to understanding this election.
It helped him, it sounds like.
It did.
Yeah. He followed, again, for the sake of context here, Phil, he follows Woodrow Wilson into the White House. Wilson, his two terms, of course, are entailed mobilizing the country for World War I. There had been this measure of turmoil with the strokes that President Wilson suffered while he was in office. Given that as a backdrop, why did the country opt for Harding, a U.S. senator from Ohio, in 1920?
Well, the sort of conventional wisdom is that the country was just tired of the campaigns, the especially the World War I, and it led to a lot of disillusionment because it was sort of oversold. The war to end all wars, to make the world safe for democracy.
Didn't quite play out that way.
Play out that way. And what I add to it is I'd say that when Harding promised a return to normalcy, and then he ran that front porch campaign, which was filmed and shown in newsreels around the country, it was not only a return to, as they called it, sound conservatism, but he's evoking peace and quiet and small town Americana, and that's sort of the underlying subtext of his whole campaign, is vote for me and I will take you back to this idealized American small town. Whereas Wilson had talked about this great League of Nations,
yes,
and this internationalism, when the country was really just not interested, was tired of it.
So Warren Harding wanted to hunker down a little bit, sort of,
yes,
get the country sort of back to its base, it sounds like.
And I think if you want to argue for Harding accomplishments, and this is abstract, but I think it's very worth considering, is he does calm the country down. Like, if you think about the end of the Wilson administration, he had a stroke. He essentially disappeared from public view, which is almost unimaginable,
yes,
today. Like,
yes,
the president just disappears for 18 months.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody sees him. there was a recession. There was the Red Scare. There was the 1919 race riots. 1919 had more strikes than any other year in U.S. history. It's just everything was going to pieces. And so that the sense of, let's just calm down, take a deep breath, everybody, we just need to kind of chill out, not how we put it, but there's some virtue to that, and there's a lot of symbolic gestures Harding does. He dedicates a tomb to the unknown soldier. He reopens the White House. He spends hours just talking with people, including the press, but just lets the public back in.
He was big with the press, given his newspaper background. He really knew how to work reporters.
There's a ton of material. I only scratched the surface in my book of journalists 1922 proclaiming Harding the next super great president.
Like
in 4, 5, 6 years, they're all going to be completely saying, "Well, I didn't write that." but 1922, they loved him. They were convinced he was absolutely the one.
A breath of fresh air, and everybody's on board with him. We talked, Phil, about how progressive he was on any number of fronts. But he also liked to give jobs to his good old buddies back in Ohio. Tell us about that part of Warren Harding.
Well, it was old-fashioned politics. To the victor goes the spoils. Harding, and I don't try and sugarcoat this, he definitely does that. So there's a new Veterans Bureau to take care of all the veterans who coming back from the war. He appointed Charles Forbes the head of it, and Forbes just engaged in wide-scale embezzlement. Similarly, he appointed – and Forbes was probably – should have been – not, you know, that was a mistake from the get-go. He had kind of a sketchy background, but Harding liked him. Albert Fall gets appointed Secretary of the Interior. He gets involved in the Teapot Dome scandal, which involves these oil leases no-bid contracts. Fall, turns out, took about $400,000 in bribes. And it wasn't the bidding process that was a problem, because he was following the law there, but it was the gifts that accompanied the bids that was the problem.
To fall.
To fall, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just sort of, you know, it was sort of convoluted. We probably don't have time to get into it. But the bottom line is Fall goes to prison.
Mm-hmm. He's the first. Is he the first cabinet member who ever went
first
to prison?
First cabinet member to go to prison for a crime committed while in the cabinet.
And just to be crystal, why we're on this moment here with the Teapot Dome scandal, which is what so many people think of when they think of Warren Harding, they think about Teapot Dome. Did the president himself, did Warren Harding profit or benefit as a result of all this stuff flying around?
Not Teapot Dome. No,
mm-hmm.
He. Yeah, he did drink during Prohibition in the White House, although he gave that up, mostly for health reasons.
A lot of folks wouldn't hold that against him, though.
No, and in some ways it's his personal life that becomes kind of bigger than life.
In what way? Yeah.
Oh, it's – okay, so what happens with Harding is you have to think about the 1920s, and we're seeing the rise of this the jazz age,
it's tabloids, the Roaring 20s.
It's the Roaring 20s.
Yeah.
And it's really the first time you see a president's personal life discussed broadly like this. Harding had mistresses, and he's certainly not the first nor the last president for that, but he is the first president to have a woman publish a book saying, "I was a president's mistress," and sort of,
wow.
And it's Nan Britton. And she basically attempts to, she writes this book and she says that I had an affair with Harding and I had a child with Harding and he was supporting my child, and then he dies, and she went to the Harding family, and they wouldn't support her, so she writes this book. And wow. It becomes a sensation. Like, you're actually talking about the president's sex life. You can't do that. And it was suppressed as pornography at one point, even though if you read it today, it's very tame. But by 1920 standards. And so what happens is it sort of gets wrapped up in this tabloid mentality, and she does become a celebrity because of this. And there's talk of you know, she tries to get a movie made. So it sort of becomes this familiar pattern that we see all the time. Like when you're standing in the cash register line, and you look over at the tabloids, and there's some story about whoever the sitting president is, and this sort of dodgy story about his personal life. That's in some ways a direct descendant of what started with Harding.
But what a trip this president goes on from the moment he dies to what we think of him today. You're saying that the press, and I gather by that many Americans, sort of thought he was a terrific president by 1822. He dies in 1823.
Right.
And then in the wake of that, you have this the sex life scandal sort of.
Which really breaks in 1927.
1927.
That's when the book comes out.
Teapot Dome then is sort of percolating, comes to life sort of after the president dies. And from there, it's all downhill for Warren Harding.
Absolutely. Harding really. His reputation just plummets. I mean, it peaks, and literally, when he dies, the nation mourns. It is a little, since we're all thinking about this, a little like with the Kennedy death. And in some ways, it's this moment of the nation comes together because the president's bigger than life, right? The president sort of embodies the nation. So, I think in some ways, it's a way for the whole country in the wake of World War I to have this kind of common moment. But yeah, he was beloved, and they start building this massive memorial to him, this really impressive memorial.
We didn't do presidential libraries in those days.
We did not.
Big mausoleums when they passed.
Yeah. Yes, and Harding, they start building one because they think he's a great president, and he dies in the service of his country. And then these stories start breaking, and then all these sort of there's a sort of piling on effect with the Nan Britton story, and other people start making claims. And so by the time it's done, nobody will dedicate it. You know, the Republicans have abandoned him. And it's not dedicated until Herbert Hoover dedicates it, essentially when it's clear he's not going to get reelected president. And he goes to Marion, Ohio, and essentially talks about how Harding was betrayed by his friends. Hmm. So you think a president – you're dedicating a presidential memorial, whoever. You just come in and say nice things, like he was president, the normal sort of platitudes. So it's really weird to read this dedication address where Hoover kind of takes the moment to you know, say – I mean, he calls it the tragedy of Warren G. Harding at his memorial.
Well, it's quite a story. Phil Payne again speaks this evening at 6:30 at the Kansas City Public Library, the Plaza Branch. More information at kclibrary.org. And again, Phil Payne's book is titled Dead Last, The Public Memory of Warren G. Harding's Scandalous Legacy. It's a pretty interesting tale for a guy who you don't think of as being all that interesting.
I think so, yes.
Thanks for coming in, Phil.